What a marvelous day it is with Sam and me. I'm Zachary. Everybody's walking down the street and they're seeing each other. And they go, hey, 6 feet away. And I say, hey, I got a mask on. And then they say, hey, whoa, hey, I got the plague. And they go, okay, at least it's not COVID-19. Hello, everybody. That was a song I wrote for about 8 weeks. This is Two Thumbs Undecided. And hello, everybody, to a wonderful new day.
I heard you working on that song as soon as COVID and soon as lockdowns started. I saw you, like, you wrote that down. Like, you have that printed out with the notes and everything.
Well, it
took a while.
It's funny. So this is Sam Ferguson, everybody. And just the fun...
See, now here's what you did. By introducing me, I am now the co-host,
some guy.
And you are the host.
I never said you're co-host. So I just said you're Sam Ferguson.
I am Sam Ferguson. We are both co-hosts of the show, Two Thumbs Undecided.
Why can't we both be hosts? You know, I find that diminishes things so radically. Like, if you go, oh, this was co-written by, it's like, okay, I didn't co-write. I came up with that stinking line in that movie that you could barely, you know, wake up to direct or, like, to write it at all. Like, I'm just saying, like, everybody should just be a host. I'm a host. You're a host. What is this, Oprah? Like,
everyone's
a host. You're a host. You're a host.
It's interesting to me how, and you could tell me if this interests you, Zach, that producer, like, in titles for films, for, like, your credit, the credit co has, like, a different, like, there's producers and then there's co-producers and then there's, like, directors and sometimes there's co-directors, but it's like a billing thing, like having the co in front, it's a way to make less money or make more money depending on what your job is.
Also, as we know from the film Mank, writing credit is very important, so you could be, you know, you don't have to produce it. Like, if you get the writing credit, that sometimes is even better than being the director. I don't know.
I actually met someone recently who was in Mank. Who met?
Was it Mank?
David Fincher. Was it Mank? I met Mr. Mank himself.
Hi, I'm Mank, everybody. I'm Manking it up here. The best thing I loved about I liked Mank a lot actually, but the best thing that came out of Mank was Netflix. Their Twitter handle, like, kept doing all these puns, like. Like, I am so mankful for Mank. Have a mankful day,
you know,
everybody.
Funny. This actually just came to me. Netflix, I saw an ad for Netflix where someone said that Netflix is now has ads for hiring that job for someone to take over for social.
Oh, I told you about that. Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
You told me. Oh, okay.
I
wonder if
how
they got
much
fired
credit
for the Mank thing.
But that was the best. A lot of my tweets around that time were all like, I'm so mankful, today is Mank Day. Like, it was like it was like talking like a smurf, like, ah, I'm so smurfing mad. It's like, ah, what the Mank.
I thought the movie was okay. Moving on. One thing I learned is this is another reason I hate Marvel. Marvel's Perlmutter, who is the one of the biggest people.
What did you say,
of
Perlmutter? Perlmutter.
Perlmutter.
What the heck is a Perlmutter?
That's his last name.
Oh, I have never heard this
Anyways,
person's name.
Well, he's one of the heads of Marvel. Like, he's the big one.
I only know Kevin Feige donated
$21 million to the American First Super PAC last year. And I guess is this, you know, after everything that went happened, he's one of the people that's holding back the money. But just saying, this Perlmutter, this bigwig at Marvel, is one of the biggest benefactors of, you know, one of the biggest GOP super PACs there
are. Oh, GOP?
So, yeah, America First. Doesn't that sound like a GOP super PAC?
Oh, yeah, that definitely sounds like a... Yeah.
Anyways, in sad news, so that's, you know, on the anti-Marvel train that I've been riding since day one. Maybe not day one, since Marvel Comics, obviously. The comics are fine, just the movies. Neil Mahoney passed away recently, who Zach is smiling for some reason.
Neil Mahoney. Like
Neil Mahoney was the comedic editor, friends with Scott Aukerman. He was the editor for Drunk History, some of the early years of Drunk History. He was the editor for a lot of the, what's it called? Between Two Ferns. He did editing. He's been all over the place.
Key and Peele.
Key and Peele. He did editing for Key and Peele. Really, I mean, for people who are new to the show, Zach and I are big fans of Comedy Bang Bang and the Scott Aukerman gang, Lauren Lapkus and Paul F. Tompkins and many others. But they're all friends with him. And
well, not anymore.
Sure, but
you were taking a long time to get to it. This person has passed, unfortunately.
I said that.
Oh, you did?
I said that, and right then I said, for some reason, it looks like Zach is smiling.
Sorry. I was trying to do some research, and someone sent me a stupid conspiracy theory on Twitter.
All right. So we sad day for a SAG or sad. Great talent, I guess, who passed away. It seems kind of just kind of died in his sleep, I guess.
Yeah, and he was only 43, which is kind of a sad thing.
So we should do an episode on comedic editors, because I think that's a whole subclass of editors.
I wonder if we could get my favorite comedic editor, which is Dog Pound. I forget his real name, but he's the guy who edited all of Tim and Eric's stuff and then went on to edit.
Vic Berger?
No, it wasn't Vic. They found Vic Berger later, but Vic Berger has that same style. And Tim Heidecker has a live podcast show called Office Hours. And it's Vic Berger. And I really should know
some
this.
Other guy.
Well, the guy is the editor, and he's he edits. Eric Andre, he edited.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
With the other guys, the editor you're talking about?
Yeah, he kind of, in my opinion, created this, this surrealist, low-brow, high-brow-ish editing style that you see in all these Adult Swim shows, where it's low-res. Anywho.
Yeah, so there's that. Also, I mean, big news. Zach and I like to support the indie film festivals that go on. One of the biggest ones was the Gotham Awards, which is a New York-based award. And some of the winners for that, best feature is Nomadland, which
I'm excited to see.
Very excited about. And if you're listening, please send us some screeners, because I feel very out of the loop this year after coming from, last year where we went to some of the film festivals.
Where they
that
treated
is
us like royalty.
Zhao.
They were like, here you go,
caviar.
Mister. Yeah, they were like, here you go, Mr. Two Thumbs Undecided.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, they would call
and we're both Mr.
Yeah, well, they called
actually,
Sam.
I was Mrs. I took the name Mrs. Two Thumbs Undecided.
Right, and I... Because Sam did that, I had to go for the Mr. But or Mrs.
Why?
I mean,
you didn't have to.
Well, that was the thing, is I said that, and then I realized, oh, wait, I don't have to be in that kind of relationship. I don't have to be a man in this relationship, but it was already too late. So Sam is Mrs. Two Thumbs, and I'm Mr. Undecided. So together we're the Two Thumbs Undecided couple.
We should have, you know how the Threedom has Weedom Threedom Boys, or they have some kind
of. Yeah, they're the potato
phrase.
Chip gang or something.
The pretzel
boys.
Something.
Yeah.
Anyways. So Nomadland won for Best Picture. I feel like that's going to start sweeping.
It's getting all
Chloe,
the.
Chloe Zhao is. She also did The Writer, I think in 2017, which I have not seen yet, but
I have
heard
no idea what
pretty
Norma...
good things about.
Normal land is thing is like
Nomad.
Nomad. See, my dyslexia sees it as Norman land, and I'm like, wait a minute, is this about a land full of Francis McDormand? Like, that's her name. It's McNorman.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was, like, a joke off her name. Like,
and then also we have, for Best Actor, we have Riz Ahmed for Sound of Metal, which I saw, and that's a great movie. It's on Amazon, I believe.
In all honesty.
For Best Actress, we have Nicole Burry and Miss Juneteenth. I don't know much about that movie, but congratulations to Nicole. And then just skimming through a little bit more, best screenplay is Rada Blank for The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which I need to see because I've heard nothing. Do you know this movie at all?
I did hear about this, and the only person I've heard from was our dear parents, and they didn't seem to like it very much.
Oh, well, I've heard it from the third thumb. Karina Dendashi, she said she really enjoys it. So we have a differing of opinions, and I've agreed with both and disagreed with both these people, so I'll make up my own opinion, but it's also winning a lot of awards, so and then to finish it off, we have Dan Salit, yeah, sure. For 14, also won for best screenplay. So I guess there was two of them. International feature is Identifying Features, which I really want to see. Breakthrough series, I May Destroy You, and Breakthrough... Oh, that's series short form. Breakthrough series long form is Watchmen. And the audience award went to Nomadland. Again, so they've... Nomadland seems to be the clear kind of winner so far of this 2020 indie world.
Yeah, and all the lists I saw of like best films of 2020, all of them was No Man Land. What is it?
Nomad Land.
So I'm excited to see what the heck it's about.
Frances McDormand is so great in everything.
I consider myself a very, very busy man. I feel like that's a song somewhere, but I consider myself a busy man. And whenever I watch a movie, I watch movies that we have to do for this, so I don't have time to watch new movies. So what I've decided is whenever the Oscars come out with their awards or whatever, I'm just going to watch those back to back. But I have to wait for a long time. Well, I told you beforehand because I have news about that.
Give us this.
And you told me that I could, or at least you didn't say anything.
I didn't say that I wouldn't have an issue with it.
Well, your silence is sometimes worse than saying something. Anyways.
I think Confucius said that.
The 2021 Oscars is taking place on April 25th in Los Angeles. It's not sure if it's going to be on the internet or in person. Either way, it's April 25th, which means that the Myers Awards will be out the 24th. Of April.
Yeah, we got to watch a lot of movies before then.
Well, exactly.
And also, that's going to be right before you move to New York. So maybe we could do it when you move.
No, I'm
moving May 1st.
No, I'm not moving in May 1st. I'm paying rent May 1st. But that's a discussion.
All right.
Either way, you'll get you'll get your dirty money on May 1st. So
thanks. That's how I like my money.
Exactly.
I also just accidentally deleted all of my notes.
Are you serious? Wait, just copy. What is it? Apple X.
No, but okay. My notes not for the main part of the show, but for this beginning thing.
Oh.
iPhones, they don't have an undo thing on the phone. It's really annoying. I have two more things.
Oh.
One, there was a really interesting article on The Current, which is the Criterion Channel, essays about micro cinema, which is theaters that have very specific a very broad range of movies that they play, and they try to have like very underground films showing at there's a few of them in New York, but not that many left. And one of the biggest ones is Spectacle, which is kind of close by, actually. I've never been, but it's a one theater and they show a shit ton of stuff, but it's an interesting read about like what these kind of theaters are doing in these times. I mean, there's indie theaters, which still get a lot of backings from big, like the IFC theater, which has still a lot of backing from rich benefactors. But then these smaller ones like Spectacle, you know, they don't have that much money coming through. So how are they surviving? A lot of them are just doing streaming stuff. But maybe we can get someone from Spectacle on the show.
See, I have to write down my notes thing, on who to
And
contact.
Then the other thing I was going to say, God damn it.
Whoa.
Pardon. Hey, if we're going to get into this guy, Louis Ben...
Oh my goodness. Okay, am I becoming the guy who can say names
Ben-Yul?
Now? It's Luis Buñuel. Buñuel.
Luis Buñuel. Buñuel. Which is weird because my last name is, or
also,
my first name is
Samuel. We should get into him because we're already 17 minutes in. All right, everybody. By the way, here's a little insight on how we do this. I bought a huge clock that I press a button, and when I hit that, whenever we start getting into it, I press the button and I see exactly where we are in time, and it's huge. It's ginormous. I actually don't know how I'm going to transfer it to New York, Sam.
Yeah, it's kind of like the, you know, in High School Musical 2.
Of course.
When summer starts coming and they're like, summer, summer, summer. And the clock behind the teacher gets bigger and bigger.
Such great, like, that's surreal right there.
That is. I wonder if they were looking at a Dali painting.
You know, I actually, I always wonder, like, you know how you hear for like a David Fincher movie or all these like Oscar-worthy movie makers, they make their crew and actors watch all these movies to get an idea. Uh-huh. I wonder if a movie like High School Musical 2 is just like, all right, Zac Efron and Ashley Tisdale, before you get into this movie, I need you to watch some essential Luis Buñuel movies. I need you to study some 1800s Renaissance painting because Zac Efron, Troy is definitely the father who eats his son. I gotta tell you. Oh my goodness. Or you are the son. I don't know. You know, like that would be funny.
You come up. I'll give that to you as an actor. Are you the person eating the son or are you the son? I wanna know later on.
Also,
that's an interesting.
You know what painting I'm talking about? Is that Uranus?
Yes.
I think that's Uranus or Neptune.
What did you just call me?
I called you.
All right.
Uranus. But this is not a painting podcast / radio show.
Could be, maybe
one day. That will be our sister podcast where we do another characters. Okay.
Two paintbrushes undecided.
Painted.
Two brushes undecided. No. Unpainted.
Yeah.
Two thumbs unpainted. Okay, let's continue.
Any hoodle, we today are talking about a essential filmmaker who paved way for filmmakers who have a very open mind of life. Called his name is Luis Buñuel, born in Spain in 1900. So right on, it makes me easier to know how old he was for his films. Because he was born right in the 1900. His first film, if you can pronounce that, my good friend.
You know, I was actually just looking this up.
It's a super, it's a very famous film, as we all know.
Yeah, so the movie is called, let me just, Un Chien à deux loups, which is
English for something dog, like the Australian dog.
Not Australian.
The Andalusian dog. Anywho.
Sure. This movie is probably most famous for the scene where it cuts the woman's eye.
So gross.
Which is very early. I mean, it's a short. It's a 15-minute surrealist short, which is made by Buñuel and Salvador Dalí.
Who were friends in college.
At the time.
So imagine
this. At the
time,
they were friends.
So imagine this, people. Luis Buñuel, just to set this the record straight, he is a famous surrealist filmmaker who's prominent through the early 30s, and then really, honestly, his most famous films to the public, I think, are his gateway films were in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. Where he was like, you know, in his 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
But a little history behind him is he was born in Spain where his father was a hardware business, successful hardware business.
He also sold firearms as well.
Oh, that I did not see. But Luis Buñuel grew up not poor. He grew up essentially rich. And he had early aspirations of the theatrics. He would do magic shows stuff and played violin for his friends. And it wasn't the movie, like any filmmaker, that got him hooked, truly hooked on that sweet, sweet feel of film, was Fritz Lang's Der Mud Toad, which is, it is is English for Behind the Wall. It's called Destiny. But in
but it
America,
seems that afterwards, he went to the University of Madrid to study philosophy against what his parents wanted. He ended up moving to Paris after, and that's where he met Salvador Dali. He moved to Paris in 1925. Did you know this? He went to, I have to say, so I'm making a bold statement very early on. I'm not the biggest fan of this guy's filmography, but
I totally
his
disagree.
History,
I
his
love-
history is probably the most interesting, I think, of any of the filmmakers that we've seen so far.
So I want to say right off the bat, I love this guy's film. Every single film I've watched of his keeps me entertained, and just I love it how it just and I, another point that I just want to say is his filmmaking is probably the closest to how I like to make films, where like things don't need to make sense, or you know, we're in the middle of talking about his history, but I want to talk about kind of his film style real quick, of how thing there are no main characters in some of his more famous films, where it's just like one person goes this way and then another person like talks to a policewoman and the policewoman goes to a doctor and the doctor tells her she has cancer. You know, it's just events, and then each event is like strange, and I love that about his work. Because the world is not, you know, you have your Disneys and you have your Marvels where you have one character and we can't enjoy or really be fascinated with like the side characters too much. The side characters are only there to push the plot. You know, people aren't just there in the world. Like when I go out to get Dunkin' Donuts with my mask, that person behind the counter has a whole life. I want to know what's going on in their life. I've already seen the main character, you know, get the drink.
Yeah. That's more of a who did Slacker? Richard Linklater. That's
Richard
like
Linklater,
a Richard Linklater idea.
Which is
this guy is not a Richard Linklater in
what you, Linklater.
Most popular director that is connected to this person is Lynch. Like Lynch and this dude are very similar.
I could see that, but you know what? I find Luis Buñuel's movies not to be horrifying. And I don't know if that's just the style of the 70s. In a lot of way, I find the movies that I watched of his to be on par with like a Mighty Python sketch, or like The Meaning of Life.
I guess I didn't see the humor as much in it. I didn't think
anything
was
really
that funny.
Not humor, but I just found things to be very lighthearted. So one of the movies that I watched of his, which was, I know.
Let's try to go chronologically, though.
Okay. But,
so what's like an early one that you saw?
So the earliest one I saw was, of course, the dog one, Julian Dog. But I saw that in college, and that messed me up because I was not
so
prepared.
Let's get to that point. So in history with that movie,
right?
So that was fully financed by his mom, and I guess by his parents, and he was shot in the surrealist style, and he had Salvador Dali and Buñuel had one role, and it was no idea or image that might lend itself to a rational explanation of any kind would be accepted. We had to open all doors to the irrational and keep only those images that surprised us without trying to explain why.
Now, Buñuel and Dali were co-writers and co-directors on this, but what kind of got it started is they wrote it in 6 days, and it was kind of prompted by some of Dali's dreams. I don't know what the heck Dali was eating or doing to get these crazy dreams, but he had a dream of his palm being covered in ants, which goes to the point of a David Lynch-esque.
Yeah.
Because David Lynch has a, what is it? He has a short called Ant Head, where it's just a ball of, and this is David Lynch, it's a ball of sugar that looks like a misshapen head, and all around the ball of sugar are these ants. It's not as interesting as the short by Buñuel and Dali, because there's actually, you know, cuts and movement. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
It's a weird movie. I like the short. Like, I think that short is fascinating. I mean, just because it seems so many things from the 30s. This was like 28, actually.
29.
Like late 20s. 29. So many things from then, I feel like, were very, like, there was, you know, there was German expressionism going on, which is a little abstract, but there really wasn't as much truly surrealist kind of just, it reminded me as well of like The Man with the Moving Camera, where it was just like, let's just experiment what we can do with a camera. And there was actually slow motion in it. There was scenes where it was slow motion in the moving, which was like, I don't see a lot of slow motion in the late 20s, early 30s. So it's like they were really experimenting with what they can do. So, I mean, there was a lot of freedom that came from that movie, I think, inspired a lot of people.
This is 29. So to them, if I saw this in theaters, this to me would have been mind-blowing.
This would have been and it blew them up. I mean, this...
Though I
mean, Salvador Dali, I think, was already kind of popular at this point.
Right, which is actually in history... And we were talking about history before, so I feel like now we're on track with history and also just his filmography. So before this movie came out, him and Dali were, you know, friends, but there was already kind of a bit of rivalry, and Buñuel was a bit jealous that Salvador Dali was already getting notarized at such a young age, and Buñuel... I could see how he's like, I'm creative, but nobody knows his name, you know.
So the interesting thing is, though, when they were making this movie, it seemed that Dali kind of got pissed at Luis, because it became clear that Luis was the director and Dali, he didn't need Dali really to make this stuff. And on the next film that Luis made, which is... La Age d'Or. Wait one sec. Yeah, which is Golden Age in
English.
Did
you see this movie?
I did not, but it apparently... It was banned in Spain.
Yeah.
And this seems to be a trend in a lot of Luis's movies. It was banned in Spain for being very anti-Catholic.
It's anti-Catholic and also like super left-leaning. And I read this thing where the anti-Jewish party, the anti-Jewish youth group, which just sounds like Nazis, and the fascist League of Patriots they threw purple ink at the screen. And would vandalize the art gallery that it was shown at.
I mean, there was a scene where Christ was leaving an orgy in the movie.
Are you serious?
So,
oh my goodness! See, that just sounds. I need to see this film.
This was kind of the end of Dali's and Luis's career together.
Right, because Dali was not. He didn't really want to be. From what I read, he didn't really want to be political. He wanted to make a statement, but he didn't want to make a revolution. Well, it seemed like Buñuel, who I feel like due to his upbringing as basically part of the bourgeoisie, was sickened by that. I could see how that would disturb. Like, he grew up rich and he grew up religious. And I think there's just a time in an artist's life where you have to question if, you know,
it's also interesting. I keep saying this. It's interesting as well. I'm going to try to find a different segue. Both the last two directors that we've done, Buñuel and also Renoir, I feel like are very similar. Renoir also grew up very rich, but then his movies started to have a much more political tint to them, very left-leaning, kind of anti-bourgeoisie. And Buñuel had loved Renoir and thought, like, really looked up to Renoir. And they actually made a movie. They made a movie adaptation of Chamber of... They made a... What was it? Ah, now I have to look this up. But the same movie of the same book called Chamber of Something. So there's a lot of connections between the two. But yeah, so anyway, so that was the 30s, or at least the beginning of the 30s. Also, apparently, Buñuel tried to kill Dalí's girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, so, trying to strangle her at a dinner party.
I read it, like, when I was reading it, it said throttle her.
Yeah.
So I assumed my mind went to, like, a sexual thing. Like, he was trying to, like, have sex with her.
Oh, see, for me, I was seeing, like, almost kind of like a cartoon where, like, you know, choking someone is just like, like, throttling. I feel like when that happens, the person being throttled, like, their neck is, like, going like, like that.
Well, yeah, anyways,
which is kind of more...
I read it wrong. Comedic. You try to kill the girlfriend. So anyways, that kind of ruined their relationship. continuing on, actually at the same time, he got a deal with MGM to go to America. He goes to America. He doesn't really do much there. He's kind of misused. Like, they try to use him to check a Spanish accent for a film, and he basically said, like, fuck off. He said, I'm here as a Frenchman. I'm not here to check Spanish accents. Like, Buñuel, he really went from all over. He was born in Spain. He went to France. He then moved to Mexico. He lived in America. It feels like he has no set country. But after the MGM stint, he went back to Madrid during the Civil War in Spain. And he made a surrealist documentary called Les Herdes, 1933, which some people say is, like, one of the first mockumentaries. And he started producing for this film production company called Filmofono, which was later revealed to be he was actually directing these films, even though he said that he was the executive producer. And he did this because he wanted to stay... he did want to hurt his image of being a surrealist, because these films were not the surrealist kind of films that you would expect. And then one of the things that I think is fascinating about his life is then in 36, this is like right when the Spanish Civil War is starting, he goes back to Spain, and he is sent to be a propagandist filmmaker, a spy, and a bodyguard for the Republic, for the anti-fascist, the Antifa, if I may be so bold, a party. And he, yeah, so he's a spy for the left in Spain during the Civil War, which is crazy. And he's making, like, these propagandist films, but eventually there's a Spanish poet that is assassinated, and he's like, peace, this is way too intense for me. I'm going to get out of here. And he vows never to go back to Spain. And he goes back to U.S. I'll try to make this quick, Zach. And if you know anything about what I'm talking about, you feel free to try.
Yeah, I really only know the beginning and his stint towards the end. And by end,
but, I mean,
the 60s.
It gets kind of crazy, though, his, like, life, because he goes to... Because it really, like you were saying, how it really was like... He was big in the late 20s, early 30s. And then he doesn't really resurface again, at least critically, until the 60s, 70s. And, like, so this whole entire time in between, he goes to Hollywood, very little success there. He's dubbing feature films in Spanish. At this point, he's just making money, making films, but none of them he's really that interested in. And he gets no success in Hollywood. Goes back and then moves to New York, actually, and starts working for MoMA. And starts working for MoMA. And this he, whenever he's asked by the head of MoMA, are you a communist? Because that was like a big thing back then. Like, are you or are you not a communist? He said, I am a Republican. And what they inferred it as is the party, a Republican. But what he meant it as is the Republicans in Spain were the people that were anti-fascists and were actually communist, like were slightly communist.
I wonder if that's
in Spain.
I bet, you know, he seems like a smart guy. I wonder if he knew that, like, or if he talked to his like agent and be like, okay, like, how do I come off to these Americans? What is like the best thing to say? Republican, which means two things. In America, that means you're a God-fearing, you know, gun-loving.
In the 40s, I don't know.
Well, it seemed like everybody in the 40s were Republican, but Republican had a much different tilt.
Well, I mean, the Democrats were winning the at least the president.
But it was definitely not as divided, at least in the 40s.
It's interesting, just this is sidetrack American history, how there was such an socialist stance nowadays, but in the 40s, you know, there was the beginning of the Red Scare, but we were also pushing through some of the biggest socialist policies at the same time. So it's just, I don't know. It's interesting how people are trying to group those two together when they're not really the same. Anyways, back to the life. So he lies and he says, or he doesn't lie. He says he's Republicans. They think he's not a communist when in fact he actually is a communist. And he starts editing a bunch of these documentaries and is like making these documentaries that are kind of in his propaganda for like the more left anti-fascist stuff. So sort of like what he was doing before in Spain. But our good friend Salvador Dali. Also, I can hear feedback coming. I can hear myself. Okay.
All right.
Our good friend Salvador Dali.
Yes.
Writes a book called
My Enemy. Buñuel.
The Secret Life of Salvador Dali, in which he exposes Buñuel of being a communist. They read the book and they're just like, "Wait, so you are a communist?" They fire his ass. And he goes to the hotel of Salvador Dali with a gun and was about to shoot him in the knee, but I guess they talked it down. But he was planning on shooting Salvador Dali for ruining his career. And but the interesting thing is that was kind of the end of Salvador Dali's fame. And this was kind of the beginning of Buñuel's, his new fame.
Isn't that interesting? Like, by the way, I feel like other filmmakers, if they are listening to this, they're probably screaming into their headphones going, like, what are you talking about? Luis Buñuel had a great, like, because he did make movies that are considered to be great pieces of art, like Verandia.
I mean, that's a little later.
I guess
that was in 40. This was still in the 40s. The next film he made, no, this was in the 40s, Verandia or whatever, wasn't until the 60s.
Oh, but here's one. Like, so in the 50s, he made a movie called Los Ovidios, which is in the 50s. So, I mean, he is still an old man, but he turned out movies every decade. Like, he didn't stop making films.
Well, what I am saying is 30s and 40s, he was mostly making a lot of documentaries. Gets kicked out of MoMA, moves to Mexico, and begets Mexican citizenship in 1949. And the biggest film he made in Mexico at the time, or at least when it kind of restarted his career as like this prominent international film director, is the movie that you said, Los Ovidios.
Yeah, sure.
And the Mexicans considered an insult on their culture. But for some reason, he was able to submit it on behalf of Mexico to Cannes, and he won for best director on that film.
Nice.
And he lived in Mexico for the rest of his life. He was given steady employment there. They loved him in Mexico, I guess. And then from then on, I mean, he was kind of jumping back and forth. He went to Spain a little bit. He worked with, or he went to France, and he made this revolutionary triptych, these three movies about the morality and tactics of armed revolution against right-wing dictatorship. And he was kind of, I mean, that seemed to be like a constant thing throughout his career, though, was like anti-fascism. He was an Antifa. Luis Buñuel
was an Antifa. There you go, everybody.
But he was still kind of struggling for cash. This is another thing, like with rich people, it's great. It's amazing that they're able to, I'm glad that these people are great artists. I respect them. But there's so many people glad I get to
watch their movies.
It's so many people. It's like if it wasn't for their parents' wealth, they would not have had any success.
I guess
he was really struggling at this time.
That's the slight classist in me, where like I hear he comes from a rich family, I go, okay, well of course you can make a film because you got the money.
But and then the movie that I think kind of restarted what we think of as like the films that are like his biggest films, Via Redina, which came out in 1961, which I started watching and got about halfway through because I fell asleep last night. But it won the Palme d'Or and was once again banned by Spain and banned by Catholics because they have an issue with anyone depicting any movie that has any type of raunchiness, has any connection with Catholicism. It wasn't even attacking Catholicism. I don't even really know what the deal was, but those were the things, I guess.
So then his next film, wait, which one did you just say? Because the film that I
Veridina.
Saw, oh, okay. I didn't see that. Did you see it?
I said I saw some of it.
Okay.
It's interesting because it has a very famous shot.
Oh, really?
In which it's these beggars who are, they're, you know, like the Last Supper painting?
Yes.
It has these beggars who are imitating that painting, but they're like these beggars who are all drunk.
I see.
And you've seen that in a lot of things. I think it's done a lot in culture since then, where they have various people who aren't like these deities in representing this thing.
They did it in MASH.
Yeah. They did it in MASH. Kendrick Lamar did it in his music video, Humble. And
it's always an interesting thing to do. So that I want to see that movie because, like I said,
it's
love his film
probably
style.
Probably my even though I didn't watch all of it.
Okay, you can't.
It's probably one of my favorites.
I feel like you
just
because
from
anything,
what I've seen.
You can say anything you want, but I almost feel like you can't because I remember there was a movie called Wages of War, Wages of Fear, about the people driving the truck of nitroglycerin. And I thought it was a fantastic film until literally the last minute. It was like one of those movies where it's like,
I skipped to the last
oh, you
part.
Did? Okay.
Which is when that scene was. So that's part of the reason.
I feel like that's cheating.
A lot. I'm sorry. I didn't like. I don't like this. I don't like this director that much. It's honestly been kind of hard for me to go through a lot of these films. Because do you want to talk about the Experimenting Angel or whatever?
Exterminating Angel. I do at that, my friend.
Because that's probably one of his next. That was 64.
So I saw Exterminating Angel, and I thought it was very interesting, and considered it almost kind of like a foreign Twilight Zone episode. Mm-hmm. Like if Twilight Zone, instead of being made in the United States, it was made in Spain. That would be one of the episodes. So what the story is, for people who don't know, is it's about a party, a bourgeoisie, so businessmen and concert directors all come over for a dinner party. And at the end of their feast, they realize they can't leave this one specific room. It's not like a room which has a door. It's like part of a room. They can't, like, go mm-hmm. past this barrier for this some threshold. Reason. This threshold. And they don't understand why they can't. They just can't. They try to bring themselves to, but then they go back in and go like, hey, I need to talk to you about this. And then eventually it becomes understandable. Like, they truly now realize, like, we can't leave. And so the rest of the movie is them trying to survive in this little room and kind of the breakdown of all these people. And there's a part where this guy needs his pills for his heart medicine. And this guy who goes crazy throws the pills, like, just past this border. And it's strange because they see it and it's right there, but they can't, like, anything that's past this barrier is gone. Mm-hmm. And the strange part, though, is that sheep and animals can come to and throw. And that's how they survive, is like some sheep come in.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
But
I feel like the...
So apparently, this is an excerpt from Roger Ebert talking about the interpretation. I didn't realize this, but here's a little excerpt on the interpretation, which goes by for what this film represents. So the dinner guests represent the ruling class in Franco's Spain. Having set a banquet table for themselves by defeating the workers in the Spanish Civil War, they sit down for a feast, only to find it never ends. They're trapped in their own bourgeoisie cul-de-sac, increasingly resenting at being shut off from the world outside. They grow mean and restless. Their worst tendencies are revealed. So they kind of, I guess that really puts an interesting spin on that.
Yeah.
Where it's just like,
I mean, it's not just...
if you cut yourself
I feel like
off.
It's not just... Yeah, it's just all... I feel like, I mean, you can definitely... It's probably inspired by the... you know, what was happening in Spain, but it's also just any, you know, closed off upper class society. So then moving on, I thought the movie was good. I think it could have been a short.
I
might have been better if it was shorter.
I think it was a good feature length. And honestly, I can't, it's one of those movies where I just can't see a movie like that being made today. I mean, you have movies like
this,
Room.
There's
but...
a scene with the hand. You know, like the scene, like the nightmare scene with the hand. I was like, this is definitely an Evil Dead 2 kind of thing.
I saw that. I thought so.
And the next film, I think it was actually apparently Salvador Dali reached out to him. This guy keeps coming up in 1966 and asked him if he wanted to make a sequel to the Un Chien Adulu film. His early film.
And did Boone Wells say no?
Yeah, he was like, your career's donezo. I'm just taking off.
Yeah, that's a great... And, what a beautiful language the Spanish language is.
I know.
You're donezo.
But the next film, and I think a lot of people say this is like one of their favorites or one of the things that is most popular, was Bella de Jour.
And you saw this, correct?
Yeah, it came out sometime in the mid-60s. And
67.
It was very, yeah, okay, 67. It was very similar to, I think, a lot of the French New Wave stuff going on at the time. And more, it was like similar to like Breathless, the sort of like where there's like gangsters involved. But I mean, it was very risque for the time. Like, the whole story is about this woman who's very sexually repressed. Like, her husband, they sleep in separate beds, and she has all these sexual fantasies. Like, the movie begins, this isn't giving anything away, the movie begins with them, with her, with this very violent sexual fantasy where she's getting, like, whipped by these horse riders.
Did it remind you
riders.
Of, did it remind you of that... very intense movie, La Liberté?
No.
Okay.
We don't talk about that movie. And so anyway, so the whole thing, and I guess one of the things with the movie is like, is this a fantasy or is this not one of her fantasies? Because she keeps having these sexual fantasies. And she goes into a brothel, basically, and is becomes a prostitute. You know, it's one of those things like in the 60s, like these were the sort of movies that weren't being made in America and that were being shown in America. And people were like, why can't we make movies like this? And he didn't like the source material, Luis. He thought it was, I don't know, he didn't like it, but he thought it was an interesting challenge to make a movie from a source material he didn't like. And this was produced by the Haakam brothers, who apparently specialize in sexy films directed by star filmmakers.
Wow, what a niche, I guess.
And the main actress, Catherine Deneuve, was Truffaut's lover at the time. So he was being pushed by a lot of different people to make a very specific type of film. And Catherine has later stated that she felt like she didn't like working with Louise. She felt like she was very exposed. You know, there was a lot of naked scenes with her, not completely naked, but like naked from the back. And she felt like there was not a lot of communication between her and Louise. It seems like there was a lot of pushing and pulling behind the scenes with this movie, but I guess it made one of his most famous.
Is it?
I think it's interesting.
Is it on Criterion Channel? Because I actually
it's
really
on Criterion.
I as a young filmmaker, and maybe a little bit after, like nowadays, which I guess I'm still a young filmmaker. I always got confused with that either being a Godard or a Truffaut movie. So because it has that style, you know.
Yeah, just kind it definitely of, has that style.
But now I know better. But so now we're going to, we only have 8 minutes left. We transfer ourselves into the future about 3 years or so, 5 years, where Luis Buñuel makes a series of films that are considered some of his greats. So You have The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, which is 1972. Then after that, in 1974, you have The Phantom of Liberty. And then his last film, that obscure object of desire. Now, I've seen all three of these films, and out of all these three, I love The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, which I went on a will, a friend invited me to go see it in theaters. And the funny thing about watching this in theaters is my friend didn't know anything about this film. He was in town and he wanted to hang out with me, and he saw that this movie was playing at this local indie film place where we've seen other films like Blade Runner and the Room. So like it's a fun time. He didn't know what the heck what it was about. Neither did I. I knew it was a famous poster where it's the lips and the top hat. But I loved it. It was my introduction to Luis Buñuel, and I thought it was so. How, like, they never could get a dinner, and it felt, part of it did feel a little Wes Anderson-y, and the best part, I thought, was there's, like, a war going outside, and this kid, like, walks up to the general and just goes, like, hello, general, and the kid goes, hey, I want to tell everybody about a dream I had, and then they stop eating, and then it just cuts away to this kid's dream. I would love it if in a Hollywood film, someone like stops in the middle. Like imagine like in Endgame, I don't know, Peter Parker just goes, hey, everybody, before we go off to battle, I had a dream last night. And like, all right, everybody quiet down. Let's listen to Peter Parker's dream. And it has nothing to do with that. It's just like Peter walking around and it never comes up again. I love that kind of stuff. And also you never know what's real. And it kind of subverts. It also kind of breaks the fourth wall in that one scene. There's a scene where they're eating dinner or they're about to eat dinner. And all of a sudden, the curtains come up behind them. And they realize
they're in
a play.
Someone else's dream, though. The thing with I watched the movie, I feel like it would have been a lot better if I saw it in theaters, as with anything. Mm. But I thought it was just, everything was a dream. I was just like, okay, this is someone else's dream. I was just like, I don't know. I got kind of tired of it after a while because there was just too many things. I was like, I guess like going into it, knowing that there's not really a plot, but I didn't care for any of the characters. Like I didn't like for all of his stuff. I just feel like it would be so much better if it was a short, if it was like a short little experiment. This one, it just went on for far too long. I was like, okay, there's some interesting scenes in it. Like there was some funny stuff, but even the fun things that you think are funny, I feel like he did it. Seriously, I feel like it wasn't done
perhaps
to be a joke.
It's probably why
I didn't find any of it.
Yeah, this is probably why it's a good thing I've never met the guy or seen any interviews, because I bet it would be where it's just like that scene where the kid is telling a dream. I had that, and they all laughed at me like they don't get it. But no, I find everything, all his stuff. I mean, I like the short he did with the eye cutting, but every movie he's done has kept me entertained. So we have 4 more minutes, so I just want to really quickly rattle off the last 2 films he made. Because now I feel like after the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, he has really gotten himself into this niche of surrealist, like stories that go into other stories. Because his next film, The Phantom of Liberty, basically, I think the theme there, of course, is nobody truly has liberty, because eventually things become unraveled in life. And it's just a story that goes from story to story to story, where like a woman is telling a story to their kids go home to their father goes into a psychiatrist, the psychiatrist lets his worker mate go to meet their father. It's just like a bunch of crazy stories. And by the way, every story is really bananas. Like there's one where a psychiatrist is telling a group of cadets and a police officer the subversion of ideas. Like, what if we lived in a world where instead of when you eat, you're taking a dump or like relieving yourself, and then when you have to go to the bathroom, you go in and you go and eat. Like, it's really disturbing. Like, they're having a dinner.
Right. And okay. What about his last movie?
And then his last movie is probably his most straightforward movie. It's about a guy who falls in love with this woman who, in my opinion, is kind of taking advantage of him. And then he also takes advantage of her. Like, it's a very destructive relationship. But the weird part about it, the only part that's weird about it, is he uses 2 actresses for the part of the woman. So ever so often, it will switch to another actress. And it's very noticeable. And I don't have enough time to explain why, like, which actor is, like, because, yeah, like, maybe it's whenever she is being rebellious and when she's being nice. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's a great, I loved it. I thought it was really good. If you want a straightforward film, watch that film.
He had a sad life in the fact that he was banned by everything that he kind of loved. Like, he was a staunch Catholic. He did love Spain, but he was kicked out of Spain because it turned fascist. And the Catholics thought he was too intense. Apparently, the last moments of his life, he died in 83. He was discussing with a Jesuit priest about the principles of being a Jesuit. And so he was always a Christian. He was just very critical of things around him. And I personally don't love his stuff. Zach does. So obviously there's...
I love his style, and I love the stories.
Yeah.
And I would like I'm influenced by him. Dare I say.
I'm influenced by his shorts. I like his shorts, and I like his concepts.
Well, I like his pants.
Anyways, so that's it for today. Next week, we'll talk about... I mean, we came up with a few ideas even just now, or during this episode, so we'll do something. But yeah, thanks for listening. And Zach, do you have anything to say?
I do. stay clean, Spider-Man.
One of these days, Spider-Man is going to be dirty.